Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. What it does is go into a very deep foundational level for why we're in the kind of debt we are individually, nationally, and globally. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. Even seasoned energy people were shocked by what had happened in Bahrain. I hope GW isn't up to something his father will pay for, said a lawyer friend of John's who specialized in the energy industry and also was a major supporter of the Republican Party. They were enjoying cocktails at a bar around the corner from Wall Street, high atop the World Trade Center. The man expressed dismay. I wonder if it's really worth it, he continued, shaking his head sadly. Is the son's career worth risking the presidency? John was less surprised than his peers, but he supposed he had a unique perspective. He had worked for the governments of Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Iran. John was familiar with Middle Eastern politics, and he knew that Bush, just like the Enron executives, was part of the network he and his EHM colleagues had created. They were the feudal lords and plantation masters. During this time in John's life, he came to realize that they truly had entered a new era in world economics. Events set in motion while Robert McNamara, the man who had served as one of John's models, reigned as Secretary of Defense and President of the World Bank, had escalated beyond his greatest fears. McNamara's Keynesian-inspired approach to economics and his advocacy of aggressive leadership had become pervasive. The EHM concept had expanded to include all manner of executives in a wide variety of businesses. They may not have been recruited or profiled by the NSA, but they were performing similar functions. The only difference now was that the corporate executive EHMs did not necessarily involve themselves with the use of funds from the international banking community. While the old branch, John's branch, continued to thrive, the new version took on aspects that were even more sinister. During the 1980s, young men and women rose up through the ranks of middle management, believing that any means justified the end, an enhanced bottom line. global empire was simply a pathway to increased profits. The new trends were typified by the energy industry, where John worked. The Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act, PURPA, was passed by Congress in 1978, went through a series of legal challenges, and finally became law in 1982. Congress originally envisioned the law as a way to encourage small, independent companies like John's to develop alternative fuels and other innovative approaches to producing electricity. Under this law, the major utility companies were required to purchase energy generated by the smaller companies at fair and reasonable prices. This policy was a result of Carter's desire to reduce U.S. dependence on oil, all oil, not just imported oil. The intent of the law was clearly to encourage both alternative energy sources and the development of independent companies that reflected America's entrepreneurial spirit. However, the reality turned out to be something very different. During the 1980s and into the 1990s, the emphasis switched from entrepreneurship to deregulation. John watched as most of the other small independents were swallowed up by the large engineering and construction firms and by the public utility companies themselves. The latter found legal loopholes that allowed them to create holding companies, which could own both the regulated utility companies and the unregulated independent energy producing corporations. Many of them launched aggressive programs to drive the independents into bankruptcy and then purchase them. Others simply started from scratch and developed their own equivalent of the independents. The idea of reducing oil dependence fell by the wayside. Reagan was deeply indebted to the oil companies. Bush had made his own fortune as an oil man. And most of the key players and cabinet members in these two administrations were either part of the oil industry or were part of the engineering and construction companies so closely tied to it. Moreover, in the final analysis, oil and construction were not partisan. Many Democrats had profited from and were beholden to them also. IPS continued to maintain a vision of environmentally beneficial energy. John's company was committed to the original PURPA goals, and they seemed to lead a charmed life. They were one of the few independents that not only survived, but also thrived. John had no doubt that the reason for this was because of his past services to the corporatocracy. What was going on in the energy field was symbolic of a trend that was affecting the whole world. Concerns about social welfare, the environment, and other quality of life issues took a backseat to greed. In the process, an overwhelming emphasis was placed on promoting private businesses. At first, this was justified on theoretical bases, including the idea that capitalism was superior to and would deter communism. Eventually, however, such justification was unneeded. It was simply accepted, a priori, that there was something inherently better about projects owned by wealthy investors rather than by governments. International organizations, such as the World Bank, bought into this notion, advocating deregulation and privatization of water and sewer systems, communications networks, utility grids, and other facilities that, up until then, had been managed by governments. As a result, it was easy to expand the EHM concept into the larger community, to send executives from a broad spectrum of businesses on missions previously reserved for the few of John's colleagues recruited into an exclusive club. These executives fanned out across the planet. They sought the cheapest labor pools, the most accessible resources, and the largest markets. They were ruthless in their approach. Like the EHMs who had gone before them, like John, in Indonesia, in Panama, and in Colombia, they found ways to rationalize their misdeeds. They promised affluence, a way for countries to use the private sector to dig themselves out of debt. They built schools and highways, donated telephones, televisions, and medical services. In the end, however, if they found cheaper workers or more accessible resources elsewhere, they left. When they abandoned a community whose hopes they had raised, the consequences were often devastating, but they apparently did this without a moment's hesitation or a nod to their own consciences. And I'll return after station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. John had to wonder, though, what all this was doing to their psyches, whether they had their moments of doubt, as he had his own. Did they ever stand next to a befouled canal and watch a young woman try to bathe while an old man defecated upriver? Were there no Howard Parkers left to ask the tough questions? Although John enjoyed his IPS successes and his life as a family man, he could not fight his moments of severe depression. He was now the father of a young girl, and he feared for the future she would inherit. He was weighed down with guilt for the part he had played. John could also look back and see a very disturbing historical trend. The modern international financial system was created near the end of World War II at a meeting of leaders from many countries held in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, his home state. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund were formed in order to reconstruct a devastated Europe, and they achieved remarkable success. The system expanded rapidly, and it was soon sanctioned by every major U.S. ally and hailed as a panacea for oppression. It would, they were assured, save everyone from the evil clutches of communism. But John could not help wondering where all this would lead them. By the late 1980s, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the world communist movement, it became apparent that deterring communism was not the goal. It was equally obvious that the global empire, which was rooted in capitalism, would have free rein. As Jim Garrison, the president of the State of World Forum, observes, quote, "Taking cumulatively the integration of the world as a whole, particularly in terms of economic globalization and the mythic qualities of free market capitalism, represents a veritable empire in its own right. No nation on earth has been able to resist the compelling magnetism of globalization. Few have been able to escape the structural adjustments and conditionalities of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, or the arbitrations of the World Trade Organization, those international financial institutions that, however inadequate, still determine what economic globalization means, what the rules are, and who is rewarded for submission and punished for infractions. Such is the power of globalization that within our lifetime we are likely to see the integration, even if unevenly, of all national economies in the world into a single global free market system." End quote. As John mulled over these issues, he decided it was time to write a tell-all book, Conscience of an Economic Hitman, but he made no attempt to keep the work quiet. Even today, he is not the sort of writer who writes in isolation. He found it necessary to discuss the work he was doing. He received inspiration from other people, and he called upon them to help him remember and put into perspective events of the past. John liked to read sections of the materials he is working on to friends so he may hear their reactions. He understood that this may be risky, yet he knew no other way for him to write. Thus, it was no secret that John was writing a book about his time with Maine. One afternoon in 1987, another former Maine partner contracted John and offered him an extremely lucrative consulting contract with Stone & Webster Engineering Corporation, SWEC. At that time, SWEC was one of the world's premier engineering and construction companies and was trying to forge a place for itself in the changing environment of the energy industry. John's contact explained that he would report to their new subsidiary, an independent energy development branch modeled after companies like John's own IPS. John was relieved to learn that he would not be asked to get involved in any international or EHM-type projects. In fact, the man told him that John would not be expected to do very much at all. John was one of the few people who had founded and managed a successful independent energy company, and he had an excellent reputation in the industry. SWEC's primary interest was to use John's resume and to include him on its list of advisors, which was legal and was consistent with standard industry practices. The offer was especially attractive to John because, due to a number of circumstances, he was considering selling IPS. The idea of joining the SWEC stable and receiving a spectacular retainer was welcome. The day the CEO of SWEC hired John, he took John out to a private lunch. They chatted informally for some time, and as they did so, John realized that a side of him was eager to get back into the consulting business to leave behind the responsibilities of running a complicated energy company, of being responsible for over 100 people when they were constructing a facility, and of dealing with all the liabilities associated with building and operating power plants. John had already envisioned how he would spend the substantial retainer he knew the CEO was about to offer him. John had decided to use it, among other things, to create a nonprofit organization. Over dessert, John's host brought up the subject of the one book John had already published, The Stress-Free Habit. The CEO told John he had heard wonderful things about it. Then the man looked John squarely in the eye. "Do you intend to write any more books?" the man asked. John's stomach tightened. Suddenly he realized what this was all about. He did not hesitate. "No," John said, "I don't intend to try to publish any more books at this time." "I'm glad to hear that," the CEO said. "We value our privacy at this company, just like at Maine." "I understand that," said John. The CEO sat back and smiling seemed to relax. "Of course, books like your last one, about dealing with stress and such things, are perfectly acceptable. Sometimes they can even further a man's career. As a consultant to SWEC, you are perfectly free to publish that sort of thing." The man looked at John as though expecting a response. "That's good to know," John said. "Yes, perfectly acceptable. However, it goes without saying that you'll never mention the name of this company in your books and that you will not write about anything that touches on the nature of our business here or the work you did at Maine. You will not mention political subjects or any dealings with international banks and development projects." The CEO peered at John. "Simply a matter of confidentiality." "It goes without saying," John assured the man. For an instant, his heart seemed to stop beating. And we will return to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now continuing with Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. An old feeling returned, similar to the ones John had experienced around Howard Parker in Indonesia while driving through Panama City beside Fidel and while sitting in a Colombian coffee shop with Paula. John was selling out, again. This was not a bribe in the legal sense. It was perfectly above board and legitimate for this company to pay to include John's name on their roster, to call upon him for advice, or to show up at a meeting from time to time. But John understood the real reason John was being hired. The CEO offered him an annual retainer that was equivalent to an executive salary. Later that afternoon, John sat in an airport, stunned, waiting for his flight back to Florida. He felt like a prostitute. Worse than that, he felt he had betrayed his daughter, his family, and his country. And yet, John told himself, he had little choice. John feared that if he did not accept this offer, unfortunate consequences would have followed. Torrijos was dead, but Panama continued to hold a special place in John's heart. Living in South Florida, he had access to many sources of information about current events in Central America. Torrijos' legacy lived on, even if it was filtered through people who were not graced with Torrijos' compassionate personality and strength of character. Attempts to settle differences throughout the hemisphere continued after his death, as did Panama's determination to force the United States to live up to the terms of the Canal Treaty. Torrijos' successor, Manuel Noriega, at first appeared committed to following in his mentor's footsteps. John never met Noriega personally, but by all accounts, the man initially endeavored to further the cause of Latin America's poor and oppressed. One of his most important projects was the continued exploration of prospects for building a new canal to be financed and constructed by the Japanese. Predictably, Noriega encountered a great deal of resistance from Washington and from private U.S. companies. As Noriega himself writes, quote, Secretary of State George Shultz was a former executive of the multinational construction company Bechtel. Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger had been a Bechtel vice president. Bechtel would have liked nothing better than to earn the billions of dollars in revenue that canal construction would generate. The Reagan and Bush administrations feared the possibility that Japan might dominate an eventual canal construction project. Not only was there a misplaced concern about security, there was also the question of commercial rivalry. U.S. construction firms stood to lose billions of dollars. End quote. But Noriega was no Torrijos. He did not have his former boss's charisma or integrity. Over time, he developed an unsavory reputation for corruption and drug dealing, and was even suspected of arranging the assassination of a political rival, Hugo Spadafora. Noriega built his reputation as a colonel heading up the Panamanian Defense Forces G2 unit, the military intelligence command that was the national liaison with the CIA. In this capacity, he developed a close relationship with CIA Director William J. Casey. The CIA used this connection to further its agenda throughout the Caribbean and Central and South America. For example, when the Reagan administration wanted to give Castro advance warning of the 1983 U.S. invasion of Grenada, Casey turned to Noriega, asking him to serve as a messenger. The colonel also helped the CIA infiltrate Colombian and other drug cartels. By 1984, Noriega had been promoted to general and commander-in-chief of the Panamanian Defense Forces. It is reported that when Casey arrived in Panama City that year and was met at the airport by the local CIA chief, he asked, "Where's my boy? Where's Noriega?" When the general visited Washington, the two men met privately at Casey's house. Many years later, Noriega would admit that his close bond with Casey made him feel invincible. He believed that the CIA, like G2, was the strongest branch in its country's government. He was convinced that Casey would protect him, despite Noriega's stance on the Panama Canal Treaty and U.S. Canal Zone military bases. Thus, while Torrijos had been an international icon for justice and equality, Noriega became a symbol of corruption and decadence. His notoriety in this regard was assured when, on June 12, 1986, The New York Times ran a front-page article with the headline, "Panama Strongman Said to Trade in Drugs and Illicit Money." The expose, written by a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, alleged that the general was a secret and illegal partner in several Latin American businesses that he had spied on and for both the United States and Cuba, acting as a sort of double agent. That G2, under his orders, had in fact beheaded Hugo Spadafora, and that Noriega had personally directed the most significant drug running in Panama. This article was accompanied by an unflattering portrait of the general, and a follow-up the next day included more details. Compounding his other problems, Noriega was also saddled with a U.S. president who suffered from an image problem, what journalists refer to as George H.W. Bush's wimp factor. This took on special significance when Noriega adamantly refused to consider a 15-year extension for the School of Americas. The general's memoirs provide an interesting insight. Quote, "As determined and proud as we were to follow through with Noriega's legacy, the United States didn't want any of this to happen. They wanted an extension or a renegotiation for the installation, the School of Americas, saying that they, with their growing war preparations in Central America, they still needed it. But that School of the Americas was an embarrassment to us. We didn't want a training ground for death squads and repressive right-wing militaries on our soil." End quote. Perhaps, therefore, the world should have anticipated it, but in fact, the world was stunned when, on December 20th, 1989, the United States attacked Panama with what was reported to be the largest airborne assault on a city since World War II. It was an unprovoked attack on a civilian population. Panama and her people posed absolutely no threat to the United States or to any other country. Politicians, governments, and press around the world denounced the unilateral U.S. action as a clear violation of international law. Had this military operation been directed against a country that had committed mass murder or other human rights crimes, Pinochet's Chile, Stroessner's Paraguay, Somoza's Nicaragua, D'Aubuisson's El Salvador, or Saddam's Iraq, for example, the world might have understood. But Panama had done nothing of the sort. It had merely dared to defy the wishes of a handful of powerful politicians and corporate executives. It had insisted that the Canal Treaty be honored. It had held discussions with social reformers, and it had explored the possibility of building a new canal with Japanese financing and construction companies. As a result, it suffered devastating consequences. As Noriega puts it, quote, "I want to make it very clear, the destabilization campaign launched by the United States in 1986, ending with the 1989 Panama invasion, was a result of the U.S. rejection of any scenario in which future control of the Panama Canal might be in the hands of an independent, sovereign Panama, supported by Japan. Schultz and Weinberger, meanwhile, masquerading as officials, operating in the public interest and basking in popular ignorance about the powerful economic interests they represented, were building a propaganda campaign to shoot me down." End of quote. And we will continue Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt-manageable life.